So when I was a kid, probably 6 or 7 years old, I used to like to take my bike out into the woods when I was up at the cottage. We had a cottage just north of Parry Sound, northern Ontario. So I used to take my bike out into the woods and, you know, take it off some jumps, some sweet jumps. And for some reason, the fresh air always kind of got my stuff moving inside. And I was riding my bike through the trails, and all of a sudden I had to take a shit, a really bad one. And I got off my bike and I stood beside it, and I just tried to like talk myself off the ledge. You know, it's going to be fine. You'll make it back to the cottage. Don't worry about it. And then being that I was only 6 or 7 at the time, my willpower wasn't very strong. So I just stood beside my bike and I shit my pants. And so now I'm standing in the woods with shitty pants, and I got to get back to the cottage now, and I got my bike. So I man up and I sit down on the seat and I just smush it all in nice, and I ride back to the cottage with my shitty pants on. And then when I get back to the cottage, I'm upset, because if my mom finds out that I shit my pants, it's going to be even a worse day than it already is. So I have this idea in my mind that pops up that I got to hide this shit. And I was thinking, where's a good hiding spot for a set of tighty whities with some shit in it? And my mind was like, you know what you should do? Go down into the basement, into the games closet, and hide it in the backgammon board. So I go downstairs, I take my shitty drawers off, and I hide them in this backgammon board. So this is like 1984, 1985. This is a long time ago. And it stayed hidden literally up until about 5 years ago. And we were sitting around the fire pit, and my mom opens the door and she comes outside and she says, "Barry, what in the hell are these?" And I was like, oh man, there they are. She found them. So
don't nobody go in the bathroom for about 35, 45 minutes.
The rule, the moral of the story is, if you need to hide something for a good 20 to 25 years, whether it's shitty underwear or any other type of thing, hide it in a backgammon board. And that's my tidbit for today.
Oh, Jesus. Oh. Right, all right, all right. Welcome to episode 3. That was Barry's little antidote to kick us off, just to let you guys know that this podcast is going to continue to be indecent for the foreseeable future. So what's happening, Barry Mack?
I said shit a lot of times, man.
You did use that term quite a bit, but I think it was fitting considering it was a story about that. As a matter of fact, our guest today is dealing with a bunch of his own shit. What's up, Andy?
Hey guys, thanks for having me. So we're toilet training our 2-year-old at the moment, and basically if I'm not photographing something or in front of my computer, I'm pretty much cleaning up shit.
Oh, that's fun.
So that's fun.
Yeah. So fun. Yeah, I've got my my 7-year-old, but we got that newborn, so I'm going to be going through that here in about 2 years myself. Fortunately, we kind of got through it pretty quickly with my 7-year-old. We just kind of got potty training out of the way in one weekend. How about you, Barry? How'd your kids do?
There was a lot of poop. You know what? I didn't mind the diaper poop, but it was the transition from the diapers to the potty, like what Andy's going through. But also after that step, and I think that my kids were just lazy and they were trying to take advantage of the system. Like, my daughter wanted me to wipe her ass until she was like 6 or 7. And I'm like, your arms are long enough. You can get back there.
Yeah.
And I don't like to do it. I don't like to deal with poop. So I just said, I'm not doing it anymore. And she had to figure it out.
Yeah.
45 minutes.
Oh man. Yeah.
Our 5-year-old was so good. Like, our 5-year-old, she basically like got it in like a,
dude, he's freezing up on us.
It's just, oh, she's just riding the system too, I reckon. She thinks it's funny, I reckon. She just likes hiding poops. We find poops in the most random places. We're like, we just finished dinner. Oh, what's that smell? And we're like, it's just like in freaking outdoors, like near their play equipment. She's just gonna dump in her little house I built for her. And her cousins were over on Easter. We just had Easter weekend, and her cousins were over, and like everyone's eating lunch. And I've literally just made a sandwich, and I'm sitting with all my family, and like my oldest niece comes in and goes, oh, Marigold's done a poo. And so I have to stop lunch, go and pick up this giant, like literally like adult size poo from the cubby house. And I deal with it and the smell's not gone. And then I look and it's literally like, it's not even on our welcome mat. It's in front of our welcome mat and it's under my heel. So then I like, yeah. So, and you know, you can't get the smell off your fingers. So, you know, then you're like going, I'm going to go get a knife and fork now to finish this sandwich. Like, it's a weird, I'm the weird guy now. I'm the weird uncle with knife and fork at the lunch table. So, yeah, so it's fun, man. It's good fun.
Jesus. Well, tell everybody real quick that doesn't know who you are, Andy, where are you? What is it you do? That kind of stuff. Just so our audience has an idea of who else is tuning in here with Barry and I tonight.
Awesome, man. So my name is Andy McPherson. My photography is focused on architecture. So 90% of my clients are architects, and I range from working with sort of single local architects right up to sort of bigger, more national, sometimes international firms. So I'm really down a niche or a niche, as some of you guys would say. And I'm in this place which, Tony, I think you said was kind of confusing. I'm in this place called Northern New South Wales. So I'm in the state called New South Wales. The capital is Sydney, so a lot of you guys would have heard of Sydney. I'm about 10 hours north of Sydney in the state of New South Wales in this little town called Kingscliff. And it's kind of like a sweet little holiday town. So every time I tell someone I'm from there in Australia that gets it, they're always like, oh, we love that place. So that's where I am. And right now it's approaching winter, but it's still like 25 degrees Celsius. So what's that, about 77 degrees Fahrenheit? So it's like beautiful.
You're speaking my language with the metrics, so we're good there.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. Is that freezing? Is there snow? What's happening with that?
It's like 25 degrees, so it's 77 degrees. So it's like semi-beach weather, depending which – probably beach weather for you in Spokane.
Nice. Well, awesome. So you may be noticing that somebody is missing tonight. Our producer, Chase Warnick, is not here. So I'm handling all this shit on my own. So I'm trying to work it all, and he usually runs the mixer and et cetera, et cetera. So hopefully the audio sounds okay. Andy – and we fixed one technical issue that we had last week with Gary and couldn't get him on. We solved that problem, but now we have a new problem. We couldn't get Andy to get connected through FaceTime. He could see us. We couldn't see him. All kinds of weird stuff was happening. So we're bringing him in through Skype, and obviously the audio is not as good on Skype as it is on FaceTime. Barry sounds wonderful as always, the soothing sounds of Raoul over there in Canada. But Andy Mack over there is, a little internet-y, so I apologize for that. You'll also hear a little bit of reverb still. Our acoustic panels came in, but I haven't had a chance to put them up yet. So we'll get those up, and hopefully by next week, all that reverb that you hear on my end will be gone. So that's enough house cleaning for the day. I figured we'd kick off maybe this week with a little Q&A, since we usually do that at the end. And why not change things up and just kick it off with Q&A today? What do you guys think? You cool with that?
That sounds good.
All right, let me see if I can find
something. Yeah, I like that.
So one of the questions that came in was, says, how much are you looking to other photographers, architecture magazines, et cetera, for inspiration? Do you find this as a benchmark to define your own style? I've been shooting architecture exclusively over 6 years now. Other than a few select photographers, find the mass of images distracting. I find critically evaluating my own work and upskilling via tutorials like yours way more helpful. No need to answer this here, just a thought for the podcast. So that was a guy named Jason was asking about that. So how about it, Andy? Where do you get your inspiration from?
Oh, definitely other photographers. There's like, we have an amazing amount of photographers over here in Australia. So I look at other photographers. I really like seeing what's happening internationally. I love drawing from photographers right back, like from the start, like Ansel Adams. Like, I think, you know, for inspiration in terms of just being innovative, just going, man, you know, that guy was just doing the coolest shit from the beginning. And yeah, just looking at sort of what's happening out there. I mean, there's so much access to great photography right now. I do get that comment sometimes, you know, a trend tends to take over an industry. So in Australia right now, everyone, you know, sometimes the style can look really similar and that can get feel a little bit bland and a little bit sort of boring or contrived. So for me down here, I like looking over to the States. I like seeing what you guys are doing over there. Here's one guy I'm really loving, Nick LeHoux at the moment, who's been around for a while. He's a Canadian guy.
Yeah, yeah, he's solid.
He does just super cool stuff. Yeah, I don't know, look elsewhere sometimes, movies.
So do you think these do you think the trends that you see, for example, the area that you're in, are those a result of photographers looking at other photographers' work and trying to mimic it, or is it a result of the client seeing work out there that their competitors have, maybe by another photographer, and requesting that of their photographers to give them a similar look? How do you think that's coming about?
That's both. So there's definitely a handful of industry leaders here that everyone looks to. And I think those industry leaders start delivering different images, you know, obviously on their social media, but probably in terms of trends more so in the magazines. And so people see that and think that's the standard. But I've literally had a client ask me to mimic another photographer's style.
Yeah, Barry has that problem too.
It's a little frustrating. Like, yeah. He literally said, I want you to deliver an image like this guy's work. And I was like, yeah, but why would you call me then?
Yeah, just call him, right?
Yeah, totally. So, I think it's mainly photographers following other photographers, but it's a little bit, I think, also client-driven because, you know, I think the photographers might set the pace and then maybe the architects sort of like that and they demand it of their photographers and it sort of becomes a bit homogenized, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, Barry, what about you, man? Are you getting, you know, inspiration? Are you pulling them from other photographers? Are you looking at magazines, you know, Dwell and Architectural Digest, things like this? Or are you just, are you the one that's setting the trends? What do you think, brother?
I'm definitely, IG is pretty inspirational for me, but I spend a lot of time, I wouldn't say spend a lot of time, but any chance, you know, I can pop by the bookstore and grab two or three Shelter mags and just flip through them. I'll even just snapshots with my iPhone of some stuff that I look more for, composition inspiration more than anything. Cause I feel like my lighting's pretty dialed and I can pretty much make any picture that's in my head. So I wouldn't even know if it's really inspiration in terms of like trends or anything like that, but I'll just see sort of an angle that I haven't quite thought of or something that feels a little bit inspirational. But I don't try to rip stuff off. I just sort of take what I see and I try to make it my own. But Instagram, I mean, there's so much shit out there. So many amazing shooters and people are putting, you know, new work up daily. So there's no shortage of inspirational stuff out there. And I mean, the stuff that Andy's shooting is crazy. Like I was on your website last week just poking around and like just some of that modern stuff, like the Cove House and the Byron Bay Rock House, like that shit doesn't exist up here. I don't know if it's because of building codes or if they're not allowed to build that style here, but I mean the stuff that you get to shoot with that like super open and airy and that whole indoor outdoor vibe is fucking amazing. Like I would love to be able to shoot that stuff, and they probably have that in California and in other parts of North America, but it's just not in my local market anything to that level.
Yeah, here neither. You know, I think that's a thing that a lot of people, it's a subject matter, right? So it's a catch-22 for a lot of newer photographers. You know, if you're shooting gorgeous properties like that, the images are inherently, you have an advantage because you're shooting good subject matter and it won't take long if you can dial in your process to start creating bangers, right? The other problem is you can't get projects like that unless you're already creating those bangers. So how do you do that shooting vanilla houses so that you can move up and start shooting the type of properties that Andy's shooting? You know, it's that catch. And I think that's the question that a lot of new photographers coming into the industry, like at our workshops and things, how do you get in to shoot? How do you build your portfolio? They want to know that. And it's like, there is no overnight answer unless Andy's got the secret. But for me, it's just working your way up, you know, grinding through it until you start getting more and more jobs. And one day that one architect calls you that does these rad houses and you get an opportunity to shoot that. And then that kind of snowballs into other architects that are looking at that architect. And I don't know, is that how you kind of did it, Andy? How did you get into shooting these rad houses?
Yeah, man, that's exactly how I did it. Before I start, though, I would love to see, you know, guys like you with your process let loose on some of these houses, because for us in Australia, we really love just, you know, sort of playing it as it lies and letting the sun do the work, you know, because we've got those big indoor-outdoor sort of spaces, and so we don't do a lot of lighting. It's really occasional. You know, if I'm on a tight deadline, I might occasionally set up an umbrella sort of outside of a window to create some sort of natural light flowing through in the space. But typically it's sunny and the big open spaces, and we have a market.
Well, all these open spaces, how are you guys not all dead? Don't you have like a lot of deadly shit up there in Australia? Isn't it like snakes and spiders down there, whatever?
Yeah. Not as much as the media would tell you, that's for sure. I was telling Barry actually that the other day we've got this like little corner in our yard, and I had like my in-laws over, and so my nieces and nephews and my kids were playing in this little section just where near my youngest daughter was taking a big dump. which this is like sort of like preceding that, but basically they're playing over in this area, and there's some old breeze blocks, and so they're brick, sort of like a brick fence with some holes in it, and they're just all playing, and then all of a sudden this like 2-meter python just sticks its head out of the wall. And everyone's just like hysterical. It's literally the room I'm sitting in, which is my home office. It's literally like about half a meter away from where the snake was. But you know what? I'll tell you what, it's not as bad as you think, but it's definitely there. But I think if anything, it's just that we're working in natural light. And so we're there all day, and there's normally sort of hard polished concrete floors. And so the worst thing we have to deal with is probably sore lower back or a sore hip or something, which is, you know, definitely the tax is worth the price to get, you know, get into these beautiful spaces and shoot them. So,
man.
So does the spaces that you're shooting, are you shooting it sort of, is it the aesthetic, the how you sort of mentioned how you shoot it, how it lies using natural light? Is it the aesthetic that you're after, or is it that you don't have the time? Cause I can't imagine with those wide open spaces and trying to match the dynamic range between the interior and the exterior space without like everything just blooming to shit. Like, are you just doing like a massive amount of bracketing and just putting it all together after the fact? Or like, how do you, if you have like a, like you're not flagging stuff or lighting stuff, like how, I can't even imagine how challenging those spaces must be.
Man, they're so challenging. I use an app at the moment called Sun Surveyor, and it just tells me the exact angle of the sun at all times during the day. And so I 3D model my shoots with this app. And so if I have time to scout it, I'll go down there and I'll stand at the property and I'll figure out exactly where the sun's going to be based on the house. And the architect will normally send me the floor plan. And so I'll literally stand at the front with the floor plan and just figure out, you know, the exact degree of the sun. And sometimes like you're just working fast, you know, at times, and you're working, you know, to the degrees of the sun. And so sometimes, you know, there's a second story bedroom that looks out to the ocean. And so you are like figuring out exactly what time that's going to happen. And so, yeah, man, I'm just working fast and I'm doing a lot of blending in post. And so I'm manually exposing for, you know, the bright parts and the dark parts, and I'm putting them together. And I suppose with our trend needing more natural light, for me, I'm about to upgrade my camera gear just so I don't have to bracket as much, if that makes sense. I don't have to stitch as much stuff together in post. Just because I think we're delivering a high amount of shots and we're working in some pretty harsh light, especially where I am. It's probably really harsh light up here, really hard shadows.
What are you upgrading to?
I'm going to go to the Fuji GFX system, but I'm going to adapt Canon TS glass and maybe some, I'm looking at this couple of bits of Schneider glass that I'll adapt on, but it's, yeah, seems a bit clunky though.
Have you had a chance to shoot with that Fuji yet?
Yeah, I went in and had a little trial with the GFX 50S. I started on the X-T2 and then I moved to a Canon system just because that TS, the tilt shift glass is so good. And then I'm on the 5DSR at the moment. It's a brilliant camera, but if I could just get a bit cleaner detail in the shadows, That's kind of like where my head's at, and I think I'll get that on the Fuji. So I'm going to get that with an adapter and probably shoot mostly Canon tilt shift.
Nice. Now the GFX S, what is it, the S? You got, that's the new, the smaller body of the one.
Yeah. Right? Oh, yeah. I'm into the 50R, which is the rangefinder body. And oh, that's so if I want to use it as like a digital back, if I want to get some bellows and put some funky glass on it, I can. But I don't think I'll use it like that much. Nice. But I've got a tech art adapter. So, yeah, man, it's just all that because it's natural light. You just want super clean shadows, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas you don't necessarily get that on the 5DSR.
You get it. You get it with the EOS R. What do you think, Barry? How's that looking for you?
I was going to ask that.
It's pretty good, man. It's still, I mean, to be honest, that, you know, we shot the upper conference room in Arizona with the GFX. Yeah. I would say that the mid-tone noise on that was comparable to my 5D4. I think that the EOS R might be a little bit better in the shadow detail, honestly.
Yeah.
Really? Do you think that's because the pixel size is going to be pretty similar on that, you know, 50 megapixels on that sort of smaller medium format sensor to the 35 mil with 30 megapixels? Is that a thing, or do you think it's more sensor tech?
Probably sensor tech, I would imagine, and software, of course, you know, inside the camera. The EOS R is same sensor that was in the 5D4. But it's got it's less noisy to me, and Barry's seen the same thing. Wow. So, considering it's the same sensor, it's got to be software related that Canon's doing. So, I don't know if maybe the camera that you're buying is a little different than the one that we got to play with in Arizona. So, maybe it's got a better software, and maybe you won't have the issues that we saw. I'm curious to see what you think. We'll have to get you back and see what you think after you get it and you start shooting with it.
Man, I'd love that. You know, it's one thing for me is I held off until Capture One because I love working in Capture One. So I'll process all my RAW files there because I think they just, especially on Canon for me, they just give slightly cleaner detail in the shadows. That's just, you know, my sort of subjective experience, especially with the sharpening in Capture One. I just like it. It's super clean. So I don't know if that's, you know, and when I heard that they weren't going to support the Fuji medium format, that's what turned me off it for a little while because I just loved so much about Capture One, especially how you could deal with colors. And then I sort of thought, oh, well, now that they're supporting Fuji medium format, I'll give it a go. And now my workflow kind of will match the camera body a little bit more, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And you know what? When we were down in Arizona and Dan was showing us, he was processing a RAW file of this. It was like an overall shot sort of a living room and how it attached to the kitchen. It showed a little bit of this balcony, and he was pulling detail out of these files, and it would be like, my mind was pretty blown. He did all this masking and stuff in Capture One. I don't know how to use Capture One. I'm still scared of it. I don't have time to learn it, but I will eventually because I know it's superior to Lightroom. But again, my workflow, I don't do a ton of raw processing at all. So one day I will get there. But yeah, I mean, there's so much information in those Fuji files that Tony, do you remember that file that Dan was putting together for us?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, I mean, you could pull a lot with it, but you got to remember at the time I was shooting with the 1DX Mark II, which you could also pull a lot with. So I don't know. It didn't, compared to what I had, it didn't make me want to run out and buy one. And I was genuinely curious about it when we first checked it out. Mm-hmm. And I'm not knocking Andy, you know, saying that what he got was a mistake. I'm saying for where we were and the equipment that we had at the time, I didn't see enough of a difference for me to run out and buy a Fuji. So I waited and then ultimately picked up the EOS R. And I've been real happy with that. Barry's happy with that too. Of course, we're already Canon fanboys, so you know there was that. So
totally same, man. You know, the thing that made me fall in love with photography was that first generation of Fuji cameras. When I was a kid, I started shooting a lot of sort of like point and shoot film cameras. You know, because I was a surfer growing up, and I just paddle out with a little film camera and try and, you know, get my mates surfing, and I loved it, but I didn't really understand the process as a teenager, and then I got more and more into it. And the thing that really made me love it was that first generation of Fuji cameras, just because you could really dial in exposure and you could understand it, and I don't know, it was just fun, man. And the cameras were so small, you sort of felt, you know, like they're a spy camera or something. They're fun, you know, compared to my Nikon at the time, which was big and bulky.
Yeah, my first digital camera was a Fuji S1, which was a competitor to the Nikon D100, I think it was called. You know, they had first come out with you know, SLRs, essentially. And it was a Fuji S1. And the reason we went with the Fuji instead of the Canon is because the Fuji had better skin tones. Or not Canon, the Nikon. The Fuji had better skin tones. So you either went with the Nikon or the Fuji at the time. And really, the Fuji was a Nikon body with a Fuji sensor in it. And then I got the Fuji S2, the S3, the S5, eventually switched over to Nikon because they were still Nikon mount. It was the Nikon F mount on a Fuji, well, essentially a Nikon body with a Fuji sensor in it. And they always made really good digital cameras. And then they kind of disappeared and they went into like, you know, almost like a point and shoot or a small, like a street photography type camera for a while. And now they're, you know, back with the medium format and that the big boys again. So it's cool. It's cool to see guys like Fuji pushing the envelope because you can get a medium format Fuji for what was that? I don't know what your exchange is, but here in the States, that camera is what, $5,000 or $6,000 or something like that.
Yeah. It's like under 10 grand.
Yeah. So versus like a Phase One or a Hasselblad that's, you know, $40,000 or $50,000. That's a huge difference to get in the medium format, you know?
Man, 100%, you know, and I think, yeah, look, I'll see, you know, if it's no good, then I'll figure something else out. I was really interested to see what Canon's going to do. Cause apparently there's this 70 plus megapixel 5DSR replacement in the R line. And so I'll be interested to see, you know, that come out too, you know, because I do love the user experience of Canon. You know, I love my 5DSR. I love one thing I really like is when you set your hyperfocal distance with Canon and you still get a focus confirmation even through the tilt shift lenses. It's just a nice little thing if I'm shooting an ultra bright. You know, I was shooting at a beach on Sunday morning. I was shooting these big buildings. I was literally wading into the ocean, hand-holding my camera so I could get the buildings reflecting in the sand. These like crazy three towers, I think it's like a $1 billion building. And I was literally wading into the beach with my 5DSR and my tilt shift lens and just having that little noise of the focus confirmation, knowing that I'd fully set my hyperfocal distance correctly. You know, just that little bit of extra sort of, I don't know, check when you feel like you've got, you know, this couple of minutes of light and you're under the pump. Just having that little extra thing, confirmation really, really is a nice sort of, you know, sort of peace of mind, I guess. So I love that user experience of Canon. It feels like you just can't get it wrong, you know?
Yeah. And the menus are just so, they're so intuitive. It's just so straightforward. It's like, if you would basically just, I don't use autofocus at all. So if all those, if those autofocus, those like 9 sub menus came out of there, I mean, it's so easy to understand and to navigate and to get where you need to go. And, I don't even know, does the EOS R have the focus confirmation? I don't know
yeah,
that I
it beeps yeah
does it beep
yeah it's got focus confirmation. So because you remember that day I lost it, I was out there trying to shoot that thing and I was like, I lost my levels, I lost focus confirmation, I can't figure out what the hell happened. It had a I had it on some sort of eye focus or some bullshit like that and I couldn't get it to work. I'm trying to shoot architecture and I was freaking out and finally I just guessed and just hoped that I got something in focus. So well, let's move on to the next question. Let's see. Somebody says, I have a question for the podcast about screen brightness settings and calibration. I've been a Mac nerd for many years and work on a 27-inch iMac. Always edited photos at full monitor brightness. I've not used a calibration device and wonder if you do, what brightness settings you guys use on your Macs. Love the podcast, guys. Solid job putting together an hour and a half of banter, which feels like chilling over beers in the kitchen with the boys. Some laughs and tidbits and more laughs. So, good. I'm glad he's digging the podcast. Hopefully everybody is. But as far as brightness goes, I'll get your guys' thoughts on this in a sec. But, you know, I used to calibrate my monitors all the time. I was using Azo monitors and even the Mac monitors and all of this. I would get the X-Rite or the Spider. And the X-Rite's more accurate, by the way. I had owned them both and tested them side by side. So for what it's worth, if you're going to spend the money, buy an X-Rite. Anyway, and when it does it, the brightness is never at full brightness. When you let the calibration tool set the brightness of the computer, it's always lower than full brightness, when it's correctly calibrated. So if you're cranking it up to full brightness, your images are probably actually, you're probably editing them, what, dark when you're done to other people?
They're going to be dark.
Yeah. To other people, they're going to be dark. So that's what Barry has experienced there.
Tony. That's the old Barry, dude.
No, they're not dark anymore. I think you turn your brightness down, but I don't know. What do you, as far as calibration, this is another thing that people would freak out, you know, when they found out that we don't do a lot of raw conversion and that stuff, and I don't do mirror lockup. And I mean, I used to do all of this stuff, but eventually there comes a time when you're talking about diminishing returns on stuff where it's such a minor difference that most clients are never going to notice it. So to take the time to do half that shit isn't worth it in the end result. And the monitors are so good out of the box these days that I don't even worry about calibrating the monitors anymore. They're so good. That P3 color space on the new Macs, the laptops and the iMacs and stuff is so good that I don't even worry about calibrating anymore. I sold my Azo monitors. What about you guys? Are you calibrating everything up? Are you still taking the time to do that? What do you think about the brightness settings?
Do you want to go?
I'll go. So one time B&H had a deal the day was a Spider Pro, and I ended up ordering one because I was always curious. I just run my iMac on, I think, like either the Apple color space or Adobe RGB 98, one of the two. The litmus test for me is when I edit a photo and I look at it on my laptop and then I look at it on my phone. And then if I look at it on like an iPad or an Android tablet, if it looks the same across all of them, which it usually does, that tells me that my monitor is doing what it's supposed to do. And I'm super anal about my color work and stuff like that. So when I did get that Spider from B&H and I went through the calibration, it made it fucking crazy, like warm and dark and weird. And the color, just like the whites on my screen felt like orange, and I knew it was wrong on a gut level, even though the calibration said it was right. So I ordered this thing, I did the calibration on it, and then I went back to just a baseline Apple setting. And like my iMac, I'm still editing on a late 2012 iMac that like this monitor probably has, you know, like literally thousands and thousands and thousands of hours, and it still runs fine. It doesn't have a single dead pixel. So for me, in terms of brightness, Tony used to get on me like, why is your shit so dark? And I used to edit at full brightness. Now I review stuff 2 clicks under full, and I actually process stuff 5 clicks under full. I just jack the brightness to full, and then I come down 5 clicks, and that's where I determine my baseline is, and my stuff has a little bit more snap. It's a little brighter than it used to be. And that's where I am. How about you, Andy?
Yeah, I do the same. So one thing happened to me early on is I was shooting for an interior designer, and they're like crazy about colors. And I got all the colors wrong, and I realized because my screen was out. And so I calibrated it. And so I'm just using Mac. And then I got a new Mac, and like Tony was saying, just straight out of the box, it was fine. So in terms of brightness, yeah, I kind of, when I used to film video back in the day, I remember there was always this guy going, just set your sound so that it's like sort of, you know, sort of 90% of the way or 80% of the way. So I always do that with my screen brightness as a rule of thumb, so it's not too bright. But the other thing, you know, I noticed that what translates really well to a computer screen translates differently to a phone screen. Especially as phones are getting bigger and the detail is getting slightly, you know, sort of different. They're obviously not as good as a Mac monitor. And so I'm finding I'm actually having to sort of do a little pre-edit to get it back to what it looks like on my Mac screen before I post it to social media. Do you guys do that?
I don't. I think everything's looking pretty good. I don't know. I mean, you said you got a newer Mac now too. I don't know if that's the one you're using for that stuff. But I found that the newer Macs are pretty close to what I'm getting on like my iPad and the iPhone. And really that's what matters, because that's where everybody's looking at everything these days, right? Is on their phone and their iPad and their Macs and their, you know, that stuff. So, you know, doing 100%. Stuff, trying to get it right for print and that kind of stuff is still important, but it's less common that people are even printing with half the photos that we create these days. You know, so many people are using them just for their website portfolios and their social media or whatever. So that's really a primary to make sure that it looks good in those areas to me. And then if I know it's going to print, then of course I'll take some extra time and make sure that the blacks aren't crushed and things like that. But
yeah,
you know,
You know what I noticed? I actually posted a shot yesterday on Instagram, and it was that shot, like that vignette type shot that showed the pantry. And for some reason, Instagram's compression, whatever tonal range is near the top of that, it's all fucking red. And I posted it and then took it down and then reposted it and took it down. And I look at it on my monitor and it's perfect. I bring it into Photoshop. Everything's perfect. And then whatever the hell Instagram's doing with their compression on their end, it's all red in there and it's driving me nuts.
Are you on an iPhone, Baz?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Man, I'm just having a look at it now. It looks amazing.
There's no red in there for you?
No.
No, no, not at all. Either. It's so clean.
That's and your
it's
like, Alibaba iPhone, dude.
have you got like a screen cover on there or anything?
Nothing, man. It's raw dog, but yeah. For some reason it's red.
That's, yeah. I don't see it, dude. It looks good. Everything you've been doing, it looks so legit. It's super tight.
Oh, man. So good. I was on your website. I was on your website now, so I was creeping on you. But it's awesome, man. It's so clean. It made me wish I could light things the way you guys light things. I'm going to have to come to one of your workshops.
Shit. You don't need it.
Well, we're thinking of coming down there, man, so.
Yeah, set us up down there. We'll come to down under and do some workshops there and see if we don't get killed by all of the venomous creatures you have there.
Oh, well, where I was suggesting for you guys to come on holiday is that one of the few places I've seen like literally like one of the world's most deadly snakes in like the biggest tourist area. Like, so there's this place called Byron Bay. Hey, do you guys remember there was this like movie? Oh, I'm trying to think. Of, Robin Williams was in it and he plays like a crazy bat. Hang on, I'm going to find it. And anyway.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember. What the hell is it called? Crazy bat? It's not Insomnia, is it?
That's in Alaska.
Yeah, he plays a crazy bat.
Oh, that's in Alaska.
No, it's, right, it's like an animated movie.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that. I haven't heard about it.
He's literally a bat? It's like a mouse with wings?
Yeah, a mouse with wings. Hang on, I'm going to find it. But he was like, it was like, anyway, it was 1992. I think it came out. I'm going to Google it.
Robin Williams' Bat movie character.
Fern Gully. Fern Gully, the last rainforest. So that is all set around the area I live. And the protagonist, I think his name was Zach. I think Christian Slater might have played Zach. It was super 90s. Jeez. But anyway, there's this place called Byron Bay, and that's set all there. So that's my reference. But it's my obscure reference to the area for you. But it's kind of like a hippy dippy area, I guess. It was sort of like, you know, like San Francisco's like the hippy dippy area from the 60s and 70s. It was our area, I guess.
It is Christian Slater, by the way. Yeah, you're right, dude. God, I didn't
know. Cheech Marin
and Tommy Chong. Good
Lord. That's crazy, man. Are you going through all the, like, you know, like how you run out of Disney movies to watch with your kids? And so you go through all those like weird ones from the 90s and like then all those other like offshoot, like random fucking animated movies with your kids. You're like, why are we watching this, but your kids love it? Are you guys, is that happened to you guys?
Yeah, and they're horrible, man. Like the animation is awful compared to what you have today. It's amazing what they can do now.
There was an obscure movie when I was a kid. And most people probably haven't heard of this. Maybe it's not even real. Maybe I made this up, but it was called The Peanut Butter Solution. And it was fucking nuts. There was a guy in it, and he would smear peanut butter on these kids' heads, and then their hair would grow, and then he'd harvest their hair for paintbrushes.
It's real. 1985, dude.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, crazy. There's a trailer on it. Yeah, this is I can't even pronounce the names that are in it.
It's so weird.
Yeah, weird. And this weird motherfucker is harvesting kids' hair for paintbrushes.
That's bizarre, dude. God. You watch some weird shit. Is this a Canadian thing or what? I never even heard of this.
It was about the same year that I shit my pants in the woods. So,
can I read an outtake from the plot points on Wikipedia?
Yeah.
Yes, please do.
Okay. Oh man, it's got Australia in there. It's our movie, man. It's our movie. Michael Baskin is an average 11-year-old boy. His father, Billy Baskin, is a struggling artist and temporary sole caregiver of the children, whilst his wife attends to the needs of a recently deceased father. Gee, I read that terribly. In Australia. Upon hearing the news that an abandoned mansion has recently burned down, Michael and his friend Connie decide to explore the remains. Outside the mansion, Connie dares Michael to take a look inside. The frightening encounter with the ghost of its homeless inhabitants who had died in the fire. Jeez.
that was brilliant. Yeah, that was brilliant. You should be a narrator in Audible. That would be good. with the Australian accent. It's kind of sexy. I'm a little aroused at the moment.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah, no worries.
It's not too nasally for you?
No, no. It's more internet-y just because you're on Skype. But let's move on to the next question.
Wait. Before you move on, before this escapes me, I need to know if the toilets in Australia actually flush in the other direction. Is that true?
Do you want me to go? I don't know. What direction do yours flush?
Clockwise.
Do you want me to go flush mine and I'll just double check? Hang on, give me a minute. Hang on. I'm going to flush mine. Hang on.
Jesus.
You guys, this is amazing.
This is amazing.
He's going to go flush the toilet. I'm going to open a beer. This is a little, dead air is not good for radio, so we got to. Yeah, I'm going to open a can of Guinness. You want to hear the soothing sounds of the widget?
Let's hear it. Oh, that's a good one. Oh, you got the nitro ones. Is that what's happening? Nice. Right on.
And I'm going to snake bite it. For those of you that don't know about the snake bite, it's this device that is handcrafted in St. Louis, Missouri. It looks mostly like a church key. However, it has two prongs like snake fangs, and it's in a lovely leather sheath. You pop two holes in the back of your can of beer. It pours out nicer. It drinks better. Go to snakebiteco.com and get yourself a snake bite.
That was a nice little plug there, man. You had the voice and everything going on. It was very soothing.
Thank you.
I just feel like I walked into a really good ad. That sounded like better than an ad.
Right?
You know, at the start of half. It sounded like. Do you guys listen to that 99% Invisible podcast?
No.
Oh, there's this really classy guy with name Roman Mars, and he has like the most beautiful accent. It sounded like that, Barry. It was gorgeous. I really want to go.
Thank you. I bet you that the Dollar Shave Club will be approaching me in no time to be doing Dollar Shave Club ads.
Oh, man, I hope so. What's stamps.com? That's the one on Mark Maron, right?
I'm not familiar with stamps.com.
Stamps.com. It's an American thing. So my toilet just flushed all whatever which way. I don't know what was happening on there.
You better get a plumber.
There's definitely
like you got problems, man.
There's a couple of skid marks.
Oh, Jesus.
Do you guys call that over here?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Good Lord.
A couple of skiddies. Do you guys know Arj Barker, that comedian?
The name sounds familiar.
He's like an American guy, but he's really popular in Australia. And he had this like thing where he's like, oh, you know, when I'm in Australia, I notice there's like always heaps of crap left on the side of the toilets. So I've got this charity idea. It's called pissthesitoff.org, and it's about taking a piss. You know when you hit the shit on stuck on the side of the toilets and you take a big piss and it washes the shit away? He goes, man, we should get some funding for that. I was like, that guy's awesome.
Yeah, I won't lie. Anytime I see a little nugget, a little burglar on the side, I try to piss it off.
Well, they put. Have you seen these guys that do the toilet mints and stuff? Now they have little flies that they put like on the inside of the toilet just to give you something to aim at, so that like drunk guys aren't pissing on the walls and everything else. You know,
that's actually quite smart.
Yeah, it actually is pretty smart. You know, especially for the people that got to clean that stuff up. So, well, yeah. this podcast is going really sideways, which is not uncommon for us. But this is a new level. So. Next question. I must have posted a video about trying just to survive a shoot because this person was responding and said, thanks for the video. Reassuring to know I'm not the only one who sometimes feels like a shoot just not working. I need to get through it. Would be grateful for some details on how you manage your time, balancing work, personal life, etc. Boundaries set with clients such as office hours and that kind of thing. So what do you guys think about that? As far as work life balance, are you working 24/7? Do you have a time you just like put down the Wacom pen and walk away and you don't come back to it the next day? Or are you of the mentality, like I'm self-employed, I work whenever I have a second? What are your thoughts, Andy? How do you work it over there?
Man, at the moment, I'm working every spare second that I can get, but I'm trying to establish some balance. And so at the moment, I've got sort of some boundaries in terms of when I'll reply to emails. You know, I used to be the guy that was probably overly keen and I'd reply to emails on the weekend. Now I just make sure it's Monday to Friday within business hours when I reply to emails and phone calls, you know, as best as I can. And sometimes there's emergencies. You know, I had this 3 missed calls, you know, like at like 7 and 8 o'clock at night about 3 weeks ago, and I'm glad I picked it up because it turned out it was one of my, you know, this really amazing architect, and he had an awards deadline and he'd lined up this shoot and he'd sort of left it to the 11th hour, and I was all ready to sort of just get back to it. It was just before the weekend. I was ready to get back to it the next week, but he needed it done. So I ended up shooting that sort of like ASAP. So, and returning it ASAP. But man, yeah, typically I'm trying to set some boundaries right now because I've got young kids and I want to give them the best of me. You know, so that's sort of where I'm at.
Yeah, kids make the difference. Before I had kids, I was working nonstop, as my wife was too. Now we have kids and it's like you have this you want to be home with your kids, but you also want to be successful at work and trying to figure all that out. How have you managed that, Barry? What have you, your kids are older than both of ours, I guess, so.
Yeah, it's right now, it's my business is, it's so, it just comes in like spurts, and it's like I have no time to do anything, and then I got like 10 days where it's like completely quiet. So the nice thing is that my kids are both in school full time, so I know that Monday morning they get on the bus at 9 o'clock and I've got till 4 o'clock to work. So I usually, if I have a project on the go, again, most of my shoot days are, you know, I'll have one or two shoot days, and then that's going to turn into a week or two of retouching work. So I know that from Monday to Friday I have from 9 to 4, and usually the kids will go home from school, we'll hang for a bit, have some dinner, and then I'll usually come down, maybe do another, try to retouch another photo between 7 and 9, and then my wife usually hits the hay pretty early too. So I work, it's not uncommon for me to work like if I have a project on the go till like 1 or 2 in the morning. But again, I might take a Friday off and go play golf or go meet the boys for some golden tea at the bar. So I work when I can. The thing is, when I have work and I have a backlog, it eats away at me, and I have a hard time relaxing if I know that I've got deadlines and I got to deliver stuff. So that's always sort of weighing me down a little bit. But I got a pretty good balance. I mean, it's nice that what we do, I mean, I was able to be around from my kids growing up, like all the time, because I was shooting real estate back then. So I would do a shoot, come home, see my kids for a bit, go do another shoot, come home, and I would do the retouching in the evening when the kids are in bed. So I have a decent balance. But yes, boundaries are important, because I used to be the same guy like Andy, responding to emails on, you know, if someone emailed me at 11:30 at night, I'd respond right away. And that's a bad precedent to set, because once you've set that, then people think it's fair game. So I think definitely, you know, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 for emails, and then just, you know, have space on the weekends. That's definitely important.
Yeah, agreed. It's, you know, what's funny is when I kind of implemented the idea of, I'm just going to cut off at the end of the day. I'm going to go home and be with my family and I'll deal with it on Monday. I was worried that, you know, clients would start going to other people or something because they couldn't get a hold of me. You know, you have that fear being self-employed that you're going to screw it all up by doing that. But it's funny is that everybody just kind of fell into line. Everybody understood. Nobody had a problem with it. Everybody was still there on Monday. The world didn't fall apart. And, you know, everything actually worked out. And it was, you know, I would be full Monday morning just responding to requests that came in on Friday and over the weekend and things like that from people. And everything just kind of works out better than you anticipate it doing. You know, it's I was really worried. It was hard to cut all that off and just say, okay, forget it. I got to pay attention to the family on the weekend. That's family time. And you just felt like your whole business was going to crumble. But somehow, miraculously, it's all still here.
So, you know what's funny about that too, and what's going on with – sorry – was Andy going?
Well, sorry, Barry, you go.
Yeah, no, what I was going to say is that...
No, you go, man.
The craziest thing right now for me, and one of the things that is always in the back of my mind, is social media. Like, if I have a deadline and I'm working towards a deadline and I post on my Instagram Live that I'm at the bar singing karaoke with my buddies, like, I feel like my clients are going to be like, what the hell is this guy doing? He's got work to do for me. So I'm always... And I know I'm not alone in that, because there's a few people on Instagram that will actually address that and be like, well, I'm at the gym right now. My client knows that I should be doing something else. So it's like, it's almost like you're, when you're putting that stuff out into the world, people are able to see behind the scenes. And when you're telling a client, like, I'm busting my ass trying to get all this shit done for you, and then they see you singing karaoke.
Yeah, man, it's so funny. I feel exactly that guilt. So two things, like I definitely feel like you did, Tony, you know, that it's weird, man. Like it's unintentional, but sometimes, you know, I got so busy all of a sudden, you know, I went from sort of, So I was working two jobs to get this business, you know, get this photography business going. And then all of a sudden I quit my other job and I got so crazy busy and I couldn't get back to everyone. And I thought that would be negative, but it's been positive. It's weird. It's not intentional, but you know, it's almost like you're a bit harder to get, I guess, in a sense.
It
and
is.
Your lead times are longer and makes people want to work with you more because
100%.
You know, but I think if they love your work, man, they're going to wait. If they love your work, they're calling you for a reason.
This is exactly the thing Barry and I were talking about yesterday. I was trying to retire this year. We had a new baby, and I'm like, I'm just done. I'm going to retire. I'm not going to have any time to work. I'm not going to return calls. I'm going to be like, I'm going to raise my rates. It'll just weed people out naturally, and then I won't have any more work to do. It worked the opposite effect.
Yeah. It does the opposite. It's crazy.
It's not even May and I have 19 shoots scheduled already and I don't know how I'm going to do them all. And I was talking to Barry. I'm like, I need help, dude. He's like, that's like 6 to 8 months worth of work, dude. What are you talking about? I'm like, no, it all has to be done by July. I have to get them scheduled and get them shot.
So, man, I know that feeling. It's crazy, isn't it? And you're running on this, what you feels like some are actual deadlines and some are sort of like, client self-appointed deadlines. Exactly. And you said, look, I gotta get all this shit done, but man, it's crazy. I had this couple of jobs that I was sort of, you know, I couldn't fit in because it's awards season over here, so it's been crazy. But I had this one job and I said, I kept sort of rescheduling back because it didn't have any particular deadline, and it ended up being like something like a 10-week wait time. I'm gonna get to it now in like June, and they inquired in March, late February, and they're just cool. But yeah, we'll wait. I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, really? And they're like, yeah, we'll wait. We'll wait for that date. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, so it's when you're doing good work, man, people want you and they're willing to wait usually. I mean, if they don't, then it's usually because they legitimately have a deadline that they have to meet. And if they're not available there, they have no choice but to go to somebody else. But
that's right.
You know, so.
Yeah,
I think that's most of the questions I want to answer for the week. But
I had one. I had one come through.
Did you? But yeah, wait, one second before you get to there. Back on the same topic though, is posting to social media when you're at the gym or whatever. How do you guys feel about posting to social media with images for a client on a project when you haven't delivered the project yet? So let's say you have, for example, 10 images on a project, right? And you have you're halfway through your edit. You've got 5 done. You just finished a banger. You want to throw that up on Instagram just to share with the world, but you haven't delivered the photos to the client yet. Is that acceptable or unacceptable?
Depends how you approach it. So it's funny. So one thing I do as part of my strategy is I try and get about, you know, at least half a dozen, maybe 10 images back to my clients ASAP, and then deliver. Depends on the shoot and what we've sort of specified, but typically there's more than that. So I try and get some of the deliverables back ASAP, and I sort of just set it up in the first meeting saying, you know, I love to capitalize on the excitement of a shoot. You know that, you know, you're so excited, you've just shot it, you know, you've got a friggin' banger in the pipe, and so I try and deliver those to my client as sort of like a teaser, if you will, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And normally with my work, rather than sort of proofing, I just deliver the finished product, and literally probably like most of my clients are pretty happy with that product. It's pretty rare that I go back and forth on retouching or doing lots of proof sheets. It's pretty rare for me down here. So they're normally cool, you know, for me. And one thing though, coming back to Barry's point, is when I shoot a project and I haven't delivered the rest of deliverables from a previous project, and I put a new one up from a recent project, and that always gets the guilt muscle flexing, you know. But my clients have never complained about it. No one's ever said, oh, you shot that and you put that guy's work up, but I'm waiting for the rest of my photos. I've never had that as an issue. So that's pretty good. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, we'll dive in later on in the podcast about actually delivering files and file delivery. It's interesting that you break yours up a little bit like that. But before we do that, Barry, what's the question that you had come in?
So this is it's kind of a multi-question. So he says, good sir, how long on average do you spend on a photo? That's question one. What's the longest you're willing to spend on a photo? That's number two. And it says, Tony outsources editing to you, but do you also outsource? How do you go about finding and vetting a retoucher? You can answer these in the podcast if you can. So
I outsource to you, and then you outsource them to India.
Yeah, yeah. And then I keep all the money.
Right. Perfect. That's great. Well, they're doing a good job, so.
Yeah, it's the second part is, what is the longest you're willing to spend on a photo? This reminds me of the chopping the garlic thing.
Right.
With my wife. Mm-hmm. My wife will ask me to chop garlic, and I'm like, why do you want me to chop garlic? It's not a special skill. And she's like, you're better at it. And I'm like, I'm not better at it. I just don't give up until it's minced. And that kind of reminds me of what, how long are you willing to spend on a photo? I'm going to work on the photo until the photo is done, whether that takes 7 minutes or 3.5 hours. I'm not just going to give up halfway through. So that's my answer to the second part of the question. The first part of the question was, how long on average do you spend on a photo? I would say that my average retouching to composite an image and do the color work and everything like that, usually somewhere in the range of 60 to 90 minutes a photo is my average. Again, I'm willing to spend as long as it takes to get it done. Tony outsources editing to you. I do not do any outsourcing. I'm a control freak, and my workflow is so specific. I path everything out, and I don't, when I'm retouching at a pixel level, it's just, I'm super anal. That's the workflow I've developed, and it is literally down to a pixel. If there's even a 2 or 3 pixel bleed where colors aren't matching up, you're going to see that. So, I don't outsource my editing, so I'm not going to talk about vetting. Tony, how about you? What do you do?
I used to do it all myself in-house, but the problem is that I got to a point where, clients want more and more images on a shoot, and you end up with, 20 images or something like that, that you have to edit, that you took 10 shots per image for, as far as compositing goes. You got to composite all that together. Then you got to do the color work. You got to do whatever other kind of, Photoshop magic that you're applying to the images, and it takes, like you say, 60, 90 minutes an image. Hell, some of them for me take longer than that when I'm editing them. I can be, 2 hours on an image if it's a real complex image on some of these bigger spaces that I'm shooting that have, lots of surface area. And so I used to be very anal. I would do all the editing myself. And then at one point in time, it just got to be so much that I was at the maximum amount of time in a day, and I was like, okay, something's got to give. I can't shoot any more jobs, or I have to outsource the editing, because there was no more time left. It was like, okay, well, I'm not shooting anything this week, but I got 5 jobs in the pipe that I have to edit and get out. So that I just, either they don't get edited or I don't do the shoots. So the only choice I had was to either turn away work or outsource the retouching. Looking at it from a financial standpoint, I can still make more money going out and collecting my day rate and passing through the cost of editing to somebody else if they can uphold the standards that I had already set with the clients, which is why you're getting the work, and Rainer's got some of the work, and other architecture photographers with good eyes mainly have gotten the work, because I can't send it out to somebody subpar and then try to deliver that to the client. They're gonna squawk at that, so. Letting go was really, really hard. It was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. What helped was having Chase, who's not here tonight, but working for me, because he's a pretty solid editor, really. And back in the day, he started doing some of the editing for me, and then I would throw my last like 10% on. Well, he got to be so good, I got to rely on that I was like, hey, I've started passing this off, and I didn't even realize it, Really, we would just split the time. We would take like a 10 shot job. He would take 5 images. I would take 5 images. We'd try to burn through them and deliver them. But I was realizing that the work he was doing was so good. And I'm like, hey, you know what? He could do all of this, and then I could take off and go out on another shoot. So that's what started happening. I had another assistant or an intern I would take out on another shoot with me while Chase was back in the studio editing, which made me twice as productive. It was like having 2 of me, essentially, yeah. And that means I had twice the revenue coming in, because I'm making money on the photos that I've already shot, and I'm making money on new photos that I'm out shooting. So once I let go and realized it was okay to let go, it was okay to delegate and outsource, and I found people that were qualified to do it, it was okay. I understand where Barry is coming from. I'm glad he's particular, which is why I send him the edits that I have. The problem is that he gets so busy in the season as well, that sometimes he can't edit my stuff, and then I have to find other sources to try to do it. And that's when things get crazy, because people don't understand the way that I shoot. They don't understand what I want edited, or they don't work to the standards that my clients expect. So I end up working late nights, or Barry ends up, sucking it up and working till 4 o'clock in the morning or something, trying to help me meet deadlines and things like that. So, it's tough, man. It's really hard. Success is a double-edged sword, you know. You try and try and try to get that work, and when you finally get it, then you have so much of it that you can't even get it all done, you know. So how about you, Andy?
Man, that's exactly where I'm at. It is a double-edged sword, man. But the all-nighters, for me, at the start of, I was doing the all-nighter thing, and then I eased into this year, and I was going to the gym, and I was, just doing those things that you neglect when you're shooting that much. And then I came to that same point as you did, Tony, where I was like, I love being behind the camera. I have got to a point where my process is probably more simpler than yours. I'm not working in as many layers because I'm not lighting as much as you guys, working in natural light. And so I've got a friend who actually has no photography experience, professionally at all. So he's kind of a blank canvas. So it's kind of inefficient at the moment, but he's a really, he sounds like your personality type, Barry. He's a perfectionist to the nth degree, and he's a musician. So he gets all those nuances. So he's got that sort of nuanced perfectionist personality type, but he's also an easygoing guy at the same time, which is hard to find. And so because he's a blank canvas, I'm basically showing him my way, and I don't think he's going to, end up in the industry. I think he's going to probably end up as a professional sort of musician or he's going to do something outside the industry. So, I trust him implicitly, so it's not a risk. But, man, it's just great to have him. And I had him on a couple of shoots, and he's just a legend. We were shooting this huge house with 1,000 square meters. So it was giant, and he was assisting me, which was awesome. And he went in the late afternoon, just before the light was getting sort of where I wanted it, and he went and bought beers. And so all of him and my clients were just drinking beers up on this balcony. So I was getting these shots, and they're all hanging over this balcony, and he's just up there. So he's having a good time. But to your point, it's one of those things where I was missing out on shoots because literally I didn't have the time to do the post, or I had to do an all-nighter to get it back. And they still happen, but you've just got to get to a point where you've got to sort of trust someone else, I think.
Yeah, it's tough. And maybe Barry doesn't have to do that. I don't know. Maybe he won't have to ever do that. Every market is a little bit different. Every photographer approaches it differently. But for me, it was a really hard thing to let go. But it didn't happen overnight. I don't think I could have just one day said, I'm busy, I have to outsource my stuff. Like I said, having Chase in the studio and just having him start to pick up retouching work here and there, and then kind of slowly move it over to him doing all the retouching, helped me get used to somebody else handling the files. And then I knew I could sit down at the end and do what I needed to do to finish them off. And he had used basically my processes to get them to that 90% mark, so I could go through and figure out what he did. And, it was all familiar to me. So,
that's exactly it. Yeah. And that's same with my guy. Yeah. So he gets you 90% of the way there, and you just come and do those necessary tweaks or those little things they miss in retouching.
And that's subjective, that's to each photographer is going to have their own spin they want to put on the images,
Totally, man. And, it's not I remember Barry, what was your thing? It was the 7 image group.
That was when I was shooting real estate. It was funny back then. I was I don't want my name to be attached to my photography. And now I'm I only want my name to be attached to my photography.
Yeah. It's amazing that, hey, I think it's that level when you start to transition, and it's more hang on, this is without sounding a total douche, this is artistry, what I'm doing. I want to put my name to it because I'm spending the hours, I'm doing this, I've dedicated my life to make sure that, the millimeter perfect compositions are on point and all of the colors are perfect. Why not? But I understand from a scalability point of view, Tony, with your name always attached to it and my name attached to it, we need to probably be the guy behind the camera 100% of the time.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, I can't send another photographer out to shoot a project. And my clients would be like, well, where's Tony? That's who we hired. It's not like I'm a plumber, A1 plumbing or something, and I'm sending out old Joe to do the plumbing. It doesn't, where they don't care who shows up as long as the toilet stops flushing the wrong way. In this case, they're hiring an artist, which is why this business is hard to sell. You build a brand, it's hard to sell a photography business because the photographer is the brand. That is what you're selling. My dad sold a studio back in, '99. He sold a studio out east and moved out to the West Coast. And, you know, selling a, it was established. So what he essentially was selling was the reputation of the studio and the client list, you know. Now the new photographer came in and maybe he's shit, you know, and loses all the clients and ruins the reputation. But at that point, my dad's already been paid. He doesn't care. It's up to the new person to do what he can to try to keep the business going. He's got to have the chops to do it. And this guy didn't actually, that company's out of business, but,
yeah.
You know, that's a tough thing about being an artist and trying to build a brand. You are the brand as an artist, and that's hard to, you know, to sell it. You are the value in that brand. So, you know, getting other people to shoot for you, go out on jobs and shoot work for you is tough. Having other people retouch for you is different because your clients don't know or don't care as long as the images come back and they look good and you were the eye out there with them, like shooting the thing, you know, so.
100%. Yeah, I'm with you, man, on that. It's and especially in that front end process, you know, like you have to do it, you know, hundreds, thousands of times, you know, to get it right in camera. You know what I mean? There's little millimeter decisions.
Yeah, the nuances that you know, what make to set you apart from the competition. The reason they're hiring you because you see all of the tangents and the intersecting lines and that stuff. That's why they're hiring you, because you have that eye.
That's it.
You know, and then of course the retouching, you're not blindly passing off to the client after it's done. It's coming back to you. You're putting your final spin on it and then delivering that to the client. So it's not like you're not still having a hand in that portion of it, you know.
That's it.
Well, guys, we're at like an hour now, so let's jump into our main topic here, and that is file delivery. That's what I wanted to talk about tonight, and mainly what method are you using to get files to your clients in multiple facets here. So you go out and you shoot a job. Are you proofing? Are you showing them? Are you shooting? Are you overshooting? Are you shooting more photos than what's on the shot list? Are you just going out? Are you working a shot list with a client? Maybe you're not, Andy. Maybe you're going out and you're just shooting a bunch of stuff and sending your client proofs and letting them choose the angles they like, and then you're retouching those angles. Or maybe you're working from a defined shot list, and then you're sending them a revision, you know, a first draft for revisions, which I think you said you're not. And then when you finally send the final files, what formats are you sending? How many different formats? What software are you using to send those? What file types are you using? Let's jump into all of that, starting with you, Andy. Talk to us about what that process is for file delivery to your clients.
Yeah, so probably the first thing to address is it really depends on the client. So sometimes there are specific shot lists, and so you're not overshooting, and you're really getting it. You're making sure that that's tight, because normally they're commercial clients that you don't want to over-deliver to. So I did one for a core hotel group recently, which is a huge – I think they're a French-based company, and they, you know, own a bunch of hotels. And so I was shooting a new venue down here. And so, the copyright agreement was really different. The deliverables was really tight. And basically that in that process, it was like a proof sheet. Of images, but like within, I think they wanted 16 images, so I delivered like 20 images because there was just a couple where I thought there's maybe a better angle based on, you know, like giving them, say, you could sort of have the camera like with a one-point perspective, or you could turn it to the side a little bit and have a little bit more sense of volume of the room and show some of the view with those particular shots. And so they went for my shots in terms of, you know, the ones I thought were going to be best. And so that was a proof situation, and I delivered it through PixieSet, which I think is a really brilliant proofing tool. And then with small architecture firms, which are the bulk of my clients, they're just trusting me. You know, they're basically the process for me is getting them to either scout the house or scout the location I'm shooting. If I can do it, sort of have time to do it. I travel a lot, so probably – You know, you, Tony, you, I imagine you end up in Seattle a little bit from Spokane, whereas I, you know, might end up really far north, you know, sort of like 90 minutes up to maybe a couple of hours, maybe 3 hours sometimes. I'll go stay overnight. So I can't always get there for a scout. So I go off the architect's plans, and then I use that app I mentioned earlier to make sure that I understand where the sun's going to be at that time of year. And then I just plan the shoot and I literally just deliver the finished product. And
yeah, I'll throw that app in the show notes. You said it was a Sun Surveyor.
Yeah, Sun Surveyor. There's a paid version, which I recommend. There's a light version, but you don't get all of the functionality, but the paid version's amazing.
Gotcha. Yeah, I use one called Sun Seeker, and I have another one, I don't think
Light Track.
Light Track, yeah. So I've got a couple that basically do the same thing. So,
and
it could depend on what continent you're on. So I'll look it up and make sure that's available, but I'll throw that in the show notes for people or one of the comparables in the U.S. if that's the only thing I can find. But they are helpful. In fact, I used one the other day. I met with a client that wants to shoot something in August, and they're wanting to know what time of day to shoot the north side of the building, which obviously doesn't get sun in the winter or fall, but in the spring and summer, you can actually get the sun comes around far enough. And so they're wondering what time in August is the best time of day to get light on the front side of the building. And I'm like, I just happen to have an app for that. I opened it up and looked at it and told them, and it just worked out really cool. Made me look good. You know, almost like I knew what I was doing.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so I used to use, in terms of delivery, so that's sort of how I plan a shoot and how deliverables work. I probably deliver more than you guys because my post-processing is, whilst it's still really critical, I'm not probably working in as many layers as you guys in terms of, you know, individually lighting things because I'm working in natural light. I can sort of, so it's just a bit quicker and the expectations on deliverables in my market is a little bit higher. And so I'm not delivering as much, and I used to use Dropbox for everything, and now I'm using PixieSet. And PixieSet is really cool because they actually have to put in their username and the password to access the downloads. And so, you know, one of the things that I don't know if you guys come up against it much is basically your client, even though you educate them on copyright, sort of trying to pass off images to third parties. And so you have more control that way.
Well, what's to keep them from sending them to third parties after they download them?
Well, that's right. But normally it's one of those things where, like, with PixieSet, you kind of catch 0 out of 100 if it's Dropbox. You know, not that it's about, you know, I hate that sort of catching thing, but not that it's about, you know, overly policing it or being, a narc or anything, but it's sort of, you got to just have some pretty clear boundaries because it's the value of your work, right? And so with Dropbox, you catch 0 out of 100, whereas with PixieSet, you know, if anyone does it, you can just email them and go, hey, you know, I just noticed you downloaded some stuff, you know, just want to make sure who you are, where you're from, who gave you access. And so that way you can make sure that the value of the images and the integrity of the images isn't compromised.
Yeah, you know? Right on. Barry, what are you doing?
We're going back to the shooting process. Usually, I will have a client on site with me, so I'm getting approval as I go along. I usually don't do a ton of advanced site visits, because I'm shooting more for designers, are my main clients and kitchen companies and that kind of stuff. So it's not, it's not for architects. It's more for, the designers and that kind of thing. So they're usually on site with me. And if they're not there, it's understood that my interpretation of the space is going to be what you get if you're not there to help choose composition and that kind of thing. But all my clients have been working with them for a long time. They know what they're going to get and they know what to expect, what, you know, my style is and what compositions I'll choose and that kind of thing. So that's how I handle that part of things. For file delivery, I'm using WeTransfer and I'll deliver high-res TIFFs, high-res JPEG, and then web-sized JPEG, which are saved in the sRGB, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Save in that color space with 300 pixels on the long edge, but everything else will be just the native resolution. So it's rare. I've had clients that most of my clients just want the high-res JPEGs and the web size, but I do get the occasional client that has a request from a printing company where they want the TIFF files. So I hate having to go back and re-deliver shit and dig stuff up. So I just always deliver all that stuff off the hop. And I tell them that the TIFF files are lossless, they're higher quality, blah, 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 blah. Keep them in a safe place. You can post the web-sized ones to social media, Facebook, that kind of thing. And then your high-res JPEG should be good enough for whatever printing you're doing. But I am trying to switch over to JumpShare. I don't have the pro version yet because I wanted to test drive it, and I'm only able to upload, I think, 250 megabytes right now. So I had to send some individual files last week, and it's pretty cool because once you drag your file into the, it's like a little kangaroo icon in the top bar, you drag it on and it instantly gives you a download link. You don't even have to wait for the files to upload. So that's pretty cool. Tony, I know you've been using JumpShare for a while. I think that that's probably the direction I'm going to go, but right now I'm just still using WeTransfer. What about you, man?
Well, all right. So this is a long episode on for me here. So, cause I got a lot of thoughts on this, but, so I started with Dropbox. And then I decided I wanted something that was even simpler. And so I went to, I looked around and I found PixieSet, which is pretty cool. And I use PixieSet, but I use it in a different way than you do, Andy. I use PixieSet as kind of a, so in a couple of different ways. One is I pay for PixieSet now. I used to use the free version and I only used it for headshots and I used it for the gallery. So what's cool about it is you can make galleries and they can make their selections and then it emails you their selections. All they have to do is click a little heart and it sends it to you and it says, Karen picked number 12. It's her headshot, you know, and you're great. So that's the one you edit and that's the one you deliver. But when you pay for it, you get some additional feature. You get the ability to monetize, which was kind of a big deal for me. And brand it and a couple other things. I like to be able to brand my stuff so that people don't feel like they're using all these third-party things, even though they are. And by being able to monetize, what I did is, if you guys have seen the tutorial, then you know I have a day rate and I use cost sharing a lot. And then if you don't get involved in cost sharing, then I have a fee to license individual images. And that fee is $375 an image for the standard usage. If you need more than that, then it, of course, changes the fee. But for the standard usage that I give everybody that does the cost sharing, if you don't get involved in the cost sharing, it's $375 an image after the fact. So what I do is I take all of the files from every project that I shoot. I upload on a PixieSet underneath a template that I've created in PixieSet for in a store, you know, because you can monetize it. So they basically come up as little stores in PixieSet. And so it makes it so that they can select images and buy those images at $375 a piece. And it has attached on their invoice what the usage is included in that $375. So I, as soon as I finish a project, I upload it to PixieSet under that template. And then later on, if somebody that wasn't involved in the cost sharing reaches out and says, hey, we saw XYZ shoot that you did. Can we look at the images? We think we want to license them. I send them the link to PixieSet. They look through it. They can make their selections, pay, and download them right there because PixieSet acts as a paywall too when you enable that purchasing feature, that payment feature. So I don't even have to get involved in it at that point. They can make their selections, pay, and download the images. They can't download them prior. The other thing it allows you to do is watermark them. So I do not watermark images for social media or anything like that, but I do watermark them for PixieSet when I'm sending those galleries to potential clients that want to license the photos so that some dirty fucking construction worker doesn't just like screenshot the thing and download it and throw it on his low res shitty website. Right. And it happens, man. And so this makes it so that it's watermarked. So only for that purpose though, as soon as they pay and download the images, they come down without watermarks on them and they can use them and they have the license attached to the invoice and stuff. So that's how I've been using PixieSet and it works really fucking good for that. So think about that. Second thing is I was using WeTransfer, and WeTransfer is a great app because you can upload to an interface on the web and send a message to a client, and you can brand it and all that stuff. You get kind of a custom URL. It's not a true custom URL. It's like yourname.wetransfer.com. So it's semi-custom, right? You send them the file, and if you send it through the web interface, they get this email from WeTransfer that's branded and everything with your information, and it says, you know, Barry sent you a file, click here to download, and they download it and it sends you a confirmation and lets you know that Jane Smith downloaded the file, right? That's all fine and dandy, but you have to open a web browser, you have to upload it to the web browser, you have to wait for it to finish uploading and then hit send. And I mean, it's just a pain in the ass. So what I found is even better. Oh, and you're only limited to zip files and things that way too. So what I found is even better is Jump Share. And this is basically works very similarly to WeTransfer. You can download the actual application to your computer. Like WeTransfer, you can have it run up in the menu bar. With WeTransfer, the version that you use on your Mac or your computer, where you just drag files up into the menu bar, you don't get confirmation of download or anything from the client when you do that. It basically just gives you a link after it's done uploading it. It puts a link on your clipboard and you can send that to your client. Whereas when you do it through the web interface, it uploads to the web and sends them and you get confirmation when they download. So that's a disadvantage of just using the menu bar portion. The other disadvantage with WeTransfer is that you don't get that URL copied to your clipboard until after the thing is done uploading. So if you're in a hurry, like I'll upload a shoot at the end of the day, send off to a client and leave the studio. Well, I can't. If I'm using WeTransfer, I have to wait until the whole thing is uploaded before I get that URL to drop into the email and send them. And then if you want to see if they've downloaded the photos or how many times, you have to log into the website and look and see. There's no iPhone app or iOS app or Android app that goes along with it that makes any sense. WeTransfer has an app for the mobile device, but it has no correlation to their web app for some reason. I don't know why it's even titled the same thing. It works really, really good, and it's a good app. And if that's what you're into, great. But JumpShare is even better because you can drag a file up like Barry said, and it gives you the URL instantly. So if you're typing an email to your client and you're saying, hey, Jane, here's the files from XYZ project that we shot the other day. You insert your link. You finish typing it all up. As soon as the images are done uploading, you hit send. Boom, that link is active, right? Or if it's the middle of the night and you know Jane isn't going to look, you can go ahead and send the email anyway. And by the time she gets up in the morning, the images are uploaded. So that's pretty nice. Mm-hmm. The other thing that it does is rather than having to go to the website to upload files and get confirmation when they download them, you can click on the little kangaroo and a little like email window comes down and you can actually type your email right there off of the menu bar, add your files to it, send it, and that will give you confirmation when they download, when they look at the files, all of that stuff, not only on your computer through that app, but you can get the mobile device and it gives you notifications on your mobile device too. So you could be at the park with your kids and it'll pop up on and give you a notification on your iPhone that says, Jane downloaded the photos from XYZ project. And you're like, sweet, now I know she's seen them, you know. There's a lot of other more customization. You can get a true custom URL. So instead of yourname.wetransfer.com, you can actually get whatever, files.annymcpherson.com, you know, so you can take your domain name, create a subdomain and have this point to that subdomain so that you're using your actual domain name. You're not using their domain name for it, which is also a bonus to me. There's a million other advantages to it. It's like the person that developed it took WeTransfer and added everything that I didn't like about WeTransfer and just made it a little bit better, you know? And it's priced a little bit less. They just to jab them, they dropped the price like $2 a month under WeTransfer. So I have a promo code. I reached out to the guy because it's just such a good app. And I always do that for YouTube videos and IG and listeners and whatever. So I reached out to him. I got a promo code. I'll drop it in the show notes. If you guys are interested in trying it out, you can try it for free, just like WeTransfer. I think the limit is 2 gig, but if you want to kick it up to a 20 gig attachment, you have to pay. It's like $8 a month or something. It's not expensive, but really, really cool. Love that piece of software. As far as the file types that I deliver, I used to deliver TIFFs. I stopped doing that because people stopped requesting them. One day I just stopped including TIFFs and I was like, I wonder if anybody will notice. If they want them, I'll give them, but nobody seems to use TIFFs anymore. So I'm not even going to bother attaching them. It just makes the files huge. So what I give now is I have three export types. One is web res, and that's 1024 on the long edge. I have Retina Res, which is 2880 on the long edge, and then I do a full res. And I include all three types of JPEGs at sRGB in my file. I compress them all, I upload those, jump share, and I send them off. Now, one more thing that I use to deliver files, which is new this year, is called Pancake. Prior, I used to use BlinkBid for invoicing because that's kind of the industry standard for, you know, commercial jobs. It's got all the line items in there and everything. It got buggy when they went to the online version from the downloaded version. So I stopped using it and I moved over to FreshBooks. And I think, Barry, you use FreshBooks, right?
Yeah, I've been using FreshBooks literally since like 2011.
Yeah, so FreshBooks is great. And I've been using FreshBooks a long time. So I moved over to FreshBooks and I was using FreshBooks for years and years and years. And they're pretty good. It's not really set up to deliver like licensing terms and description of the project and all of that stuff. But they're doing a good job of making a really simple invoicing solution. And you can see when your clients have looked at the invoices, which is really cool. So they can't be like, well, I never saw it. So, you know, you haven't paid this invoice yet. Well, I never saw it. Yeah. Bullshit. You looked at it at 11 AM on Friday the 24th. And you know, you know exactly when they looked at the invoice, right? The problem is you send clients files, right? So you'd send that same dirty construction company, some files and he doesn't pay you for 6 months, right? And they're usually the notorious ones is the contractors, right? The architects aren't the problem. Usually the engineers aren't the problem. It's the contractors. Yep. They're always a fucking problem. So you send him files and he doesn't pay you and you end up chasing money from this guy for months, right? Or any client that is a one-off client, you know what I'm talking about, the one-off clients, not your regulars, but the ones that call you for a project and you're like, sure, I can do that. And you go do it and you send them the files and then you never hear from them again, right? So I was trying to figure out a way to combat that. And you can't do that through FreshBooks. And there's very few pieces of software out there that you can set up a paywall with really that's clean. I know you can do it through Squarespace. There's a few other ways you can set it up, but it's just not clean. And I want to have a little bit of passive aggressiveness in there. So I found an app called Pancake. And the caveat to Pancake is it basically works just like FreshBooks, except instead of running in the cloud, it runs on a server. So you have to get server space, which you can get from any web host, be it like 1on1 or Bluehost or InMotion Hosting or any of those. I use InMotion Hosting. It's like $90 for 2 years of web space, right? So, and what happens is you buy this piece of software for $170, whatever it is. You download it and you upload it to these database on your web server. And you basically create your own software application called Pancake. It's an invoicing application. And it works very, very similar to any other invoicing application, very, very similar to FreshBooks, where you get notifications when they look at the files and all of that stuff. So you know if somebody's seen it, when they logged in, you know, all this kind of stuff. That you don't have to create a login, which I love. I hate making clients create logins and usernames and passwords. And Andy, you were talking about that a minute ago. I don't like doing that. I want people to just be able to click a link and be able to look at images or download images. I want to make it as simple as possible. And so this allows you to do that, that you can send them a link to an invoice. They click it. They're viewing the invoice. They scroll down through the bottom. And at the very bottom, it says files available when paid in full. And what happens is on my end, I can attach files to the invoice from my end. It uploads the files and it sets up a paywall inside of this invoice. So as soon as they pay it, they can download the files. And that's brilliant to me because that keeps that dirty fucking contractor from being able to run off with my images without paying me. So if he doesn't want to pay me, so be it. He'll never get his images. But as soon as he pays, that link at the bottom of the invoice becomes active and he can click it and download the images. So it just makes it so that I know I'm getting paid before he gets his files. And I can be kind of passive aggressive about it. I recently did a project for a Harvard Review, right? And these organizations make you jump through hoops and paperwork to set yourself up as a vendor. And then you send them the images. And then 6 months later, they finally process payment and send it to you. And I didn't want to wait that long. And she was in a real hurry for the images. And I'm like, hey, you can download them today. All you got to do is click that link at the bottom and pay the invoice. And then you'll be able to download the images, you know? And so she was like, well, that's not really how our accounting department works. And I was like, well, unfortunately, I've already attached the files to the invoice and there's nothing I can do about it until the invoice is paid. They're kind of tied up to that. Lo and behold, within 24 hours, her accounting department managed to make it work and paid the invoice. And she got her files and I got my money. And that was the end of that. So anyway, that's a long, long thing I just talked through. But
you missed one part, Tony. The part where how you said that if folks want it expedited, you give them the option. They want to write a check. It's going to take 10 days for the check to get to you before that link becomes active. And you said that you can also bill the merchant fees directly to them with credit card, right?
Yeah, so that's a couple other cool things about Pancake, and I'm not trying to push this piece of software. It's just something that I discovered that kind of checks all the boxes for me. And what Barry's talking about is with most like FreshBooks or any other invoicing software, you can set up to take credit cards either through Stripe, which looks just like they're paying with a credit card, or you can set up PayPal, which, you know, feels a little third party-ish, but, you know, people are familiar with PayPal these days, so it works. But FreshBooks works that way as well. Pancake, you can attach either with Stripe or FreshBooks, and so that they can pay with either of those services. Or what I do is I give my clients the option. They can pay with a check. They mail me the check. When the check comes in, I process the check. I deposit it. When the check clears, I mark it in the invoice system as paid. That link becomes active. They can download their images. That might be a week. If they're really in a hurry, they can click that link. They can pay with a credit card today, either with a credit card or through PayPal, and have that link active and download the files today. But what's cool about Pancake is you can set it up for them to have to pay the fees for the credit card or the merchant fees. So if it's PayPal, I think they charge, what, 2.9% or 3% or something like that. So it automatically attaches that to their invoice, and it pops up with a little notification box to them and says, you've chosen to pay with PayPal. There will be a 2.9% transaction fee associated with it, you know, and do you accept? And they say yes, and it adds that as a line item on their invoice, and they have to pay that, so it's not taking it out of my pocket. It does the same thing if they decide to pay with a credit card, which is ultimately processed through Stripe. It charges them the fees that Stripe would normally charge me. And that's just a tick box on the back end, whether you want to charge those fees to the client or you want to eat those fees. And of course, I clicked them both and said, yeah, charge it to the client. If they want their files right away, they can have them, but they have to pay the merchant fees. You know, that's the price of instant gratification. So it works really well. I've been really happy with it. Haven't had a single problem with it. It's not for somebody who, like my mom, isn't going to figure out how to use this, right? You have to have a little bit of tech savvy because you have to go through their process of setting it up on a server. And then you have to open up like a config window and like change the maximum upload size and some things like that. So it's, they have help files for all of this. It's not that it's impossible. I don't consider myself a code monkey by any stretch, but
you're a nerd.
Yeah, I'm a little bit of a nerd. So you got to be a little bit of a nerd to set this up. But you don't have to be a code monkey. But at the same time, like I said, my mom isn't going to figure out how to do this, you know.
So, or me. I won't figure it out either.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I can help you. But it's really cool. So if you have any savvy, if you've worked with WordPress, then you can figure this out. If you're a format or a 22 slides or a Squarespace kind of guy, you may not figure this out. So you need just about enough programming knowledge as you would need to set up a Squarespace website, or not a Squarespace, a WordPress website. So, but it's really cool. I'll post a link to it down in the show notes and you guys can check it out. It's pretty cool. I've been happy with it. And what I've noticed is that I don't have any outstanding balances. I mean, I send a thing out and clients are willing to pay the 2 or 3% to pay with a credit card to have their files right away. My long-term clients, I'm not using that for. I'm go ahead and send them the file. I know I'm going to get my money from them. They're on a regular pay schedule of the 15th of every month. They cut checks or whatever. So I don't do that for them. This is just for those clients that, I might not get paid from this guy for a while. I'm going to go ahead and send it this way, you know? So
I like that. I think that's good advice because there's a lot of photographers that, you know, you guys have probably experienced this. It's a little bit feast or famine, you know, suddenly you've got, a bunch of people that, you know, in the old school way, a bunch of people that aren't paying you at the same time. And then you're going, how am I going to pay my rent or mortgage or whatever? And then all of a sudden everything comes, you know. I don't know if that's your experience, but it certainly was my experience. So, Tony, that sounds like a good option.
Yeah, it works, man, you know. And I've been around enough where I'm not diehard. I'm not hurting for the money, you know, if I have a client that's not paying me. But it's still annoying to see that balance carried on your sheet from month to month. And you're like, this asshole's never going to pay me, man, you know. And you're having to make, just wasting time chasing money down. I just don't like to do it, you know.
It's a respect thing, you know. I remember like one of my old employers, he was just like, it's a respect thing, you know, to a huge degree. You know, sometimes there's some legitimate reasons why people can't pay you on time. To your point, you know, I've had some bigger architecture firms, you know, like sort of multinational guys, and they just have some pretty strict payment policies. But it's funny when you say, actually, you know what, if you want these photos delivered, you're going to have to pay. It's funny how quickly they can bend those rules, right?
Yeah, I mean, they have these hard and fast rules until they really want the files, and you kind of, you throw 100%. It in their court and you're like, well, you can have them today. You just have to figure out how to pay this invoice. You know, there they are. They're sitting right in front of you. There's a link right there. You want it to go active, pay your bill. And amazingly enough, they miraculously figure out ways to get it paid pretty quick. So all that other stuff is bullshit, you know? And I'm doing that with everybody, you know, that I know pay slow, like agencies, I know they pay slow. So I'm using that system for them now too, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it's weird how the companies with the deepest pockets, they have the most rules and they take the longest to pay. And meanwhile, the little companies are like, yeah, here's your check, man. Thanks so much. Can't wait for the next project.
And I get 100%. Part of that. Part of it is because they're a small company. It's one guy owns it and one guy writes the check, you know, and the bigger the company gets, they have accounting departments and everything else, but it really is, a lot of red tape that you can cut through if you do this and you put it in their court and you're like, there they are. You can have the images. You just have to figure out how to get to them, you know? So
100%, man. But I think that's like, you know, for me, I'm a little more manual. I'm not as integrated in terms of my payment process, but having to have a download PIN has been excellent. Like, so especially for third parties that want to license the images, so you can proof the images to them and then say, once you pay for the images you've selected for your usages, you then can download them with this PIN once that's been actually that transaction's occurred. So that's been really good for me from a third party point of view. Whereas, you know, some, like you, to your point, have these long-term relationships with these great people and you just know you're going to get paid.
Well, you're using PixieSet though, so keep that in mind. You can set up those basically what they call them, I think, in PixieSet as a store. So you can take every project and upload it as a new store and set it so that people have to pay before they can download the images. And then you don't have to worry about pins or any of that stuff, you know? So,
man, I'm going to do that. Let's write that down. You know, the other thing I have to say from, you know, just to come back to PixieSet is what I love over here. You know, being published is, you know, it's a big deal. I suppose it's a big deal anywhere. But being published in print, especially for architects, is a big thing. And there's sort of two ways that happens. There's the magazines that will commission you to shoot, but they're typically the more commercial magazines. And the reason they commission you is they want to commission you so they have more usages from the images. And they're sort of saying, hey, we're going to pay you X amount, and it's going to be not too dissimilar to what you're used to getting paid, but we're going to ask for broader images, and the trade-off is you're going to be in a national magazine, but ultimately we're going to have all the say in the art direction. And typically most architects, I mean, they're great to be in, but typically most architects in my experience, in my part of the market, don't necessarily value being in those magazines as much as the other tier of magazines, which are more the architectural and design journals. That are normally better in print quality, have better photography, and they take images on spec. And for me, PixieSet was a great way because most people are delivering via Dropbox. And so you get all those thumbnails, you get a list of photos. But what I found with PixieSet is you actually have something that, you know, you open that link and it almost looks like an editorial layout.
Yeah. And it gives them the instruction too, the gallery assistant. You know, you can turn that on and it tells them how to go through the gallery. That's invaluable.
100%. Because
people don't know how to work the things a lot of times when they jump on there. And this walks them through it, which is pretty sweet.
100%, man. And I think, you know, obviously the photos have to be banging. You know, you have to, because it's all, at the end of the day, an editor only cares about where the photos fit in a magazine and the quality. But I think also to cut through some of the initial noise, especially, you know, again, for new photographers that are listening to this, I think it's one of those things where presenting it to a publisher in that way probably help you cut through the noise a little bit more, just that little bit more, give you that little bit of edge.
Yeah. So anything to add, Barry?
No, I think you guys have covered it all.
Cool. Well, I think with that, we're at an hour and a half, actually an hour and 38 minutes. So we probably ought to wrap there. Shit. We're going to lose people if our podcasts keep running an hour and a half long. So I apologize to anybody that's still listening that it's run long. But I think there was some good information at the end there. With that, Andy, where can people find you online, man?
Yeah, cool. So my website is just it's www.andy, and then it's a hyphen, so a dash, McPherson, which is MacPherson.com, and then Instagram. So I'm Instagram, and then / Andy McPherson Studio. They're my main two things. I like to keep it nice and simple. So find me there. Come say good day.
Right on, right on. And where in Australia are you?
I'm in Kingscliff, which is right up in the north part of the state of New South Wales. So I'm about 10 hours north of Sydney, and I'm almost on the border of Queensland and New South Wales, which are the two biggest states.
Right on. Well, hopefully we can catch up with you and maybe do a workshop over there later this year. Barry, where do people find you, brother?
You can find me on Instagram at SWIZZLER. And yeah, how about you, Tony? Where can we find you?
Well, you can find me at Tony Roseland on Instagram, on Twitter, on YouTube. You can also find us at Pixel Punishers on IG or Twitter. You can also visit website pixelpunishers.com for the show notes, as well as our past podcasts. You can listen to this podcast on iTunes, Google, or Spotify. And one last thing almost forgot about before we go is Barry's bookshelf. Barry, what do we got on the bookshelf this week, brother?
Okay, so I've left the Holocaust for a moment, and I've jumped back into a couple sort of self-help books. I'm huge into self-help books, and there's one that I go back to often. There's actually three I'm going to mention. We're going to put in the show notes. The one is called The Confidence Gap. It is written by Russ Harris. Amazing book, and it says The Confidence Gap. It's a guide to overcoming fear and self-doubt. And I think as creatives, I don't know if you guys are the same as I am, but I definitely suffer from imposter syndrome, which is a crazy thing where you don't believe that you're as good as you think you are. And it fucks with your head a little bit. So this book talks about mindfulness and how to monitor your thoughts, but not to fuse with them, and how to just sort of watch what's going on and how to identify emotions and that kind of thing. So it's huge, I think, for all creatives. It's a great read. Mm. I wrote some notes here that I was going to talk about, but the show's running so long that I'm going to say is give it a look. It's called The Confidence Gap by Russ Harris. And the two other books that go along with that, there's one called Learned Optimism by Martin Seligman, an amazing book, more mindset type stuff. And then the other one is Mindset by Carol Dweck. So those three books, I know that for me, being a creative and sometimes having these sort of excessive expectations and fear and self-judgment and that kind of things, it really helps with that stuff. So,
yeah.
Well, Andy, hey, man, it was good to chat with you, brother. Thanks for tuning in with us. Another thing is that you are our first guest, brother.
Oh, wow. Thanks for having me. That's an honor.
Yeah. I mean, technically we tried to have Gary last week. It didn't work out, but you are our first successful guest that we've had on the podcast. Assuming that I can edit this and actually get it published successfully, you will be our first guest on the podcast. So,
wow. Thank you for having me. That's awesome.
Thanks for being a part of it, man. And we'll catch you guys on episode 4 next week. This one will go out to the airwaves later tonight. So thanks, everybody, for tuning in. That's it for this week.
Peace. Peace.